Stone. Wanna see my picture on the cover. Stone. Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother. Yeah. Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is Rolling Stone magazine. The June 2025 edition. Random Notes. Princess Diary. Marina is ready to enjoy life to the max. The cult favorite singer tells us about the playful pop and deeper introspection of her latest album. There's a bridal shower just a few tables away from Marina as she sips a berry smoothie in the sun-dappled courtyard of a Los Angeles hotel and tells me she's trying not to protect her heart quite so carefully these days. I've dove into my fear of love, says a singer, age 39, who made her new album, Princess of Power, from the perspective of a superheroine whose greatest power is love. She says, it can sound trite, but I think the ability to love is so powerful and brave. It's a courageous thing, particularly if you've been hurt. It can be really hard to reprogram yourself, and I think I've been finally able to do that. Fans got a taste of what's to come with Princess Power at Coachella, where Marina debuted the album's standout single, Cantamissimo, twirling across the stage in a blonde wig and a corset dress echoing the album's cover. She also revisited songs from the early days of her career, when she performed as Marina and the Diamonds. Think How to Be a Heartbreaker and Prima Donna, both from 2012. These are the songs that built her deep-rooted fan base, which now includes the like of Olivia Rodrigo, Billie Eilish, and Chappelle Roan. Fortunately, I haven't had to rely on charts or commercial success for much of my career, Marina tells me. It's a wonderful thing to know those early albums had impact, because at the time, I still felt very small as an artist. Her 2010 debut, The Family Jewels, introduced an avant-garde pop talent who was unafraid to be cookie and cerebral. Her conceptual sophomore album, Electra Heart, cemented her legacy, helping make her a cult favorite for tumble teens and all pop obsessives. As she approaches her 40s, Marina says she's embracing life with no holds barred. Princess of Power offers playful pop tinged with deeper introspection about growing older. I was trying to access this euphoric energy that I wanted in my everyday life, she says. That was the blueprint for this record energetically. For Cantamissimo, Marina was inspired by icons like Elizabeth Taylor, Sophia Loren, Madonna, and Rihanna, women who enjoy life to the max. She grabs the Gen Z adopted term cunty and reframes it as a celebration of bold, unapologetic femininity. That's really key, pleasure, she says. Throughout the centuries, it's been denied us that freedom to be silly and messy. Women have been under such a strict, patriarchal power for so long, but this is just like, fuck you. Metallic Stallion, another highlight, is dedicated to a lover afraid of deep connection. On the album's title track, Marina tells me she reteaches herself how to love, and on Roller Coaster, she manifests finding it. It's almost always come true, she says. Marina tells me she's been single for a while now. She pulls out her phone to read me a roomy quote from her therapist that sent her. It says, your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you've built against it. In other words, there's an open door to love in Marina's life, but it has to be the right connection. She says, a lot of us, I think, prioritize romantic love, and I have by force, and had to reconsider that. That's massively part of this album as well. Most of all, though, Marina wants her listeners to enjoy themselves when they listen to Princess of Power. I just really want it to have a positive impact, she says. Otherwise, what's the point of doing anything? Also from Random Notes, One to Watch,
Eva Victor is Hollywood's most original new voice. The writer, director, and star of Sorry Baby was a viral internet personality. Their debut film shows a deeper side. Eva Victor is carrying a ludicrously capricious bag when I can't help but reference the now memed to death Succession bit. Victor juts out their jaw and says in a pitch-perfect Tom Wamgunson impression, Shiv. I'm relieved, if not surprised, that Victor got the reference. The actor, writer, director, who is 31 and uses they, she pronouns, has spent the past decade or so as a niche internet presence, going viral periodically with satirical videos and bone-dry one-liners. Someday I hope a man takes off my clothes with the same care he takes off the tinfoil of his carnitas burrito. But now they're introducing themselves to a whole new audience in a whole new way with Sorry Baby, an intimate, poignant drama that just closed out the Cannes Film Festival in May and will be released in theaters by A24 on June 27th. The film, which Victor wrote, stars in, and marks their directorial debut, heralds the arrival of a singular voice. Victor suggested we meet today at Color Me Mine, the pottery painting studio in Pasadena. They've recently started painting as like my new lifestyle. As we consider potential color palettes, I note that Victor is wearing four different shades of green, including an olive-colored crystal pendant tied to a string around their neck. It's a wishing necklace, a Christmas gift from Victor's cousin. Victor explains, you make a wish, and when the crystal falls off, it means the wish is coming true. So either I have a necklace, or my dreams are coming true. What a perfect situation. Victor should get ready for that necklace to break. The early accolades for Sorry Baby, which won standing ovations at its Sundance premiere, are well-deserved. Quietly stirring and wryly funny, the film stars Victor as Agnes, a grad student turned English lit professor, and captures the events leading up to and following her sexual assault at the hands of her thesis advisor. As she fights to retain a sense of normalcy, Agnes runs up against institutional failures at the doctor's office and university admit office, panic attacks, and bodily disassociation, and the creeping suspicion that everyone else, including her best friend Liddy, a sparkling Naomi Aki, is moving on with their lives while she remains frozen in place. While Sorry Baby is centered around trauma, it isn't one note. Victor deftly toes the line between soul-shaking hurt and sly observational humor. The film is also based on Victor's lived experience, though they are reluctant to share details. Whatever you want to know, the answer I want to give you is in the film. Victor. That Victor has a private streak might seem ironic, given how they first came to prominence via comedy videos, which were all over Twitter and TikTok as COVID took hold in 2020. Until that point, Victor had been living a typical post-grad creative life in Brooklyn, New York, giggling in the stand-up world and working part-time at the satire site Reductress. Thank Victor for then viral, now classic headlines like, I never thought I would find love, and then I didn't. But when the pandemic shut down New York's live comedy scene, Victor was quietly relieved. Performing would cause me a lot of anxiety, they say. I really didn't want to talk about my private life on stage. The best stand-up people are willing to be completely transparent in certain ways. Instead, Victor worked on their screenplay, hunkering down at a place in Maine that they've sublet from their cousin. It was intense. It was super wintery. I got my car stuck in banks of snow, but it was cool. I was using it as a time to be introspective. When the screenplay was ready for other eyes, Victor sent it to director Barry Jenkins, who sent them an encouraging note on Instagram. Victor also had a champion in director Jane Schoenbrunn, who let Victor shadow them on set while filming last year's I Saw the TV Glow. Schoenbrunn tells Rolling Stone, "Victor is a true star. There's no one else on earth with anything close to their style. That strange mix of psycho charisma and deadpan awkwardness. I'm in awe of their bravery and wit and artistry." No doubt audiences will place Victor in that star category soon. Is she prepared for that attention? Not quite. When I was writing this film, it was a joyful experience to have it exist so privately, Victor says. I'm excited to go back into my private zone. We now turn to this edition's The Rolling Stone Interview. Cory Booker, "People Want to Know You Give a Shit," by Tessa Stewart. Cory Booker has been railing against Donald Trump's agenda from the floor of the Senate for 3 hours when his feet started to go numb. On the lectern, he had his cell phone out, against Senate rules, with his family group chat pulled up. Every now and then, it pinged with a message of encouragement or a photo of an absurdity-shredded bald dude, the motivational speaker, ultramarathoner, and former Navy SEAL David Goggins, instructing Booker to stay hard. Booker's family read Goggins' book together back in 2021. His cousin Pam tells me, "We developed our own internal language, like, stop feeling sorry for yourself. Stop acting like you're doing something hard. Let's Goggins it out. Anytime we thought we were suffering, we'd say, well, have you broken both of your legs and taped them up with duct tape and cardboard and gone and run 10 miles like David Goggins did?" Booker started shifting from one foot to another as he spoke, rocking back and forth, trying to regain sensation in his lower extremities. By the time he finished speaking 22 hours later, pillowy puffs of synthetic fiber had gathered in piles around his feet. He had worn holes in the Senate's floor royal blue carpet. But he had Goggins it out, surpassing the record set by the South Carolina Senator Strom Thurmond, who filibustered but failed to stop the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1957. By the next Saturday, after shaking each hand and grinning obligingly in every selfie following a town hall in Paramus, New Jersey, Booker sinks into the back of a black SUV exhausted. "I had food delivered to my house this morning, fruit and stuff like that, for energy. Amazon says it was delivered, but there was nothing on my doorstep. So I have no food at home," he says mournfully. "I just wanted some fruit to wake up to." For Booker, a vegan for more than a decade, there'll be no pit stops for Jersey's famous Taylor Ham. But we're just about to pass one of Newark's handful of vegan restaurants, and it's still open. He bounds through the door triumphantly, only to be told they had just sold clean out, so he heads to the ice cream shop, also vegan, next door. You might think by this point in the week, Cory Booker would be tired of talking. But in case you failed to grasp this watching his 25-hour speech, this is a guy who loves to yap. Within a few minutes, he's earned every detail of the ice cream shop's owner backstory, persuaded her to make him his own cookie dough-filled ice cream flavor. He already had a name in mind, Dough Unto Others. And he's recorded a video message to her husband telling him, "We both know you married up." Booker himself has never been married. A relationship with the actress Rosario Dawson ended in 2022, but the pair remained friendly. After his speech, Dawson posted on Instagram, "We're so proud of you. Go sleep now." Booker ate a banana and went straight into making a live appearance on the Rachel Maddow Show instead. At age 56, Booker still retains the boy's puck from back when he was elected the youngest councilman in Newark's history at the time. There, Booker quickly figured out that harnessing the attention of the media was the best option he had to effect change in the city. His first year in office, he set up a tent outside of Garden Spires, a notorious drug and crime-plagued housing project, where he slept for 10 days, refusing food, and successfully shamed the mayor and landlord into improving conditions there. Booker keeps a map of Newark's Central Ward on the wall of his Senate office in Washington, D.C., besides bookshelves festooned with pop culture memorabilia. Back in his office at the Capitol a few days after our drive through Newark, Booker shows off his boxed, mint-condition Lieutenant Nyota Uhura Star Trek figurine, his Broadway cast recording of The Wiz. I was crying watching the stage in 1974. I was only 5 years old, and he took me back to see it three times. And the Wall Street's original pointillist portrait of Martin Luther King Jr. Booker offers me a water in a Batman-branded pint glass and sips from his own Green Lantern one. He talks like a pinball machine, a dizzying, discursive style that ricochets from one point of reference to the next. One question might elicit a 16-minute soliloquy that begins with the birth of his father, weaves through the long arc of American history and the shorter arc of his own life and political career, name-checking the New York Times writer Ezra Klein, Oprah Winfrey, Tyler Perry, the gospel singer Mahalia Jackson, and half a dozen of his congressional colleagues along the way. Printing that answer alone in full would take up more than double the amount of space allotted for this interview. So here, edited for length and clarity, are the best bits of Booker's two-part conversation with Rolling Stone. Question: what was the moment you committed to the marathon speech on the Senate floor? Booker: the fight over the continuing budget resolution and whether Senate Democrats would give the Republicans the vote needed. We had three heated caucus meetings in a row, and the yelling inside got so bad that reporters on the outside were hearing us, and staff on the outside would be texting, "You guys need to quiet down." When we made that decision to give Republicans enough votes to pass the budget, I felt so deflated, and then heard from my constituents this eruption of frustration. I went back to my staff, and I said that we need to take some individual action. I've been hearing that challenge from constituents. Take risks. Do something. We don't feel like you're doing enough. I'm here because we did unorthodox protests when I was coming up in Newark. When you are technically powerless, when I was a city council person, they had all the votes. And Mayor Sharp James was a very powerful person. It forced me to think out of the box. Question: the speech reminded me of your Garden Spires demonstration in that way. Booker: that was a moment that most parallel in terms of I was ready to quit. There was a woman who walked me up and down Garden Spires to get me elected, saying to people, "This kid just got here. You don't know him, but you know me. This is who we're going to support." I wouldn't be here today without her. I think we got into the runoff by just 12 votes. A year later, she's calling me for help, and I'm telling her I can't help her. Right now, a lot of Democrats are saying, "We don't have the votes. We can't help." When I got out to Garden Spires, that woman, Elaine Swole, came over to me, and I thought she was going to get mad at me because we had literally yelled at each other on the phone, and I hung up on her. But she saw me and treated me like the prodigal son, and I realized I was yelling at her, telling her I couldn't do it. I didn't even go there. I didn't even show up. That really was what she wanted. She just wanted me to show that I cared enough to come out and stand with her or listen to her, you know. I think people understand that their politicians aren't going to wave a wand and fix everything. They just want to know that you're going to give a shit. Question: how did you prepare physically? Booker: I had the benefit of Senator Chris Murphy's 2016 stand. Booker stood alongside the Connecticut senator as he held the floor for 14 hours and 15 minutes in protest of the government's inaction on gun control. I got a lot of data from what I was really facing. I realized that going to the bathroom thing, which was the biggest thing I was obsessed with, was not as hard as being on your feet for 15 hours. It gave me a lot of data to think about. "Okay, am I going to biologically hack myself to make it through?" I said. "I'm going to fast until I get to Kyotis, because I know that when my liver is run through all the glycerin, then you shift to burning ketones. You get very focused and a lot of energy. I learned that by my intermittent fasting days. I stopped drinking water the night before, and 24 hours of not drinking was too much. I didn't need to do it. By the end, as I felt my hands and leg muscles cramping up, I realized I was definitely dehydrated, and I just started shooting water in the last 5 hours, saying, "Screw it about the bathroom thing." I know if I made it past the 20th hour, I could go for the record, and that adrenaline would probably pull me through. Question: why not filibuster an actual piece of legislation? Booker: the way the modern Senate works is they often will use procedural tactics to never give the opposition a chance to come in, so doing a real filibuster is very, very hard. In the modern Senate, it's very hard to even get control of the floor. I said to my team, how did Ted Cruz get control of the floor? How did Rand Paul? Figure out how they got control. The person in the cloakroom told me, very annoyingly, we let Rand Paul take the floor because he promised it was only going to be a couple of minutes, and he lied through his teeth. Are you willing to lie to Senate Majority Leader John Thune? I said. That's not the way I roll. I'm not going to lie. So let's just let them know I'm going to take control of the floor and hold it for as long as I possibly can. Question: there was this powerful moment when you shouted out Republican Senator Chuck Grassley, and it almost felt like you were trying to resurrect the spirit of bipartisanship from the energy you created in the room. Did you have any hope for bipartisanship at this point? Booker: I definitely do. I have enough conversations with Republicans now who will tell me things privately that many won't say publicly. There are people that don't agree with some of the things that the president's doing, and that shows me that there's potential to stop those things from happening. The only hope we have of stopping some of the big things that I think are most menacing about the Trump administration is to get votes from the other side. You can't get that if you are demeaning and degrading, and don't give anybody a pathway for them to do the right thing, a pathway for them to act out of conscience and not necessarily out of their politics. Question: when you were a member of the New York City Council, an executive from your own party, Mayor James, threatened and bullied you. Can you relate to your Republican colleagues, those who feel threatened by Trump on that level? Booker: no. I mean, look, there were definitely really scary times in Newark when cops would warn me, "We're following you." My father was always flipped out about, would somebody try to set me up, like plant drugs in my car or whatever. There's a lot of physical fear or worry that I had in my early career. I still remember when Faith Hochberg, this federal judge, was warning me, "You are not safe." She made me connect her with my mother because she just didn't think I was taking the threat seriously enough. One of my supporters hired a former Mossad agent to assess my security. He basically tells me, "This guy is screwed. He is being followed. He lives in these projects that don't have any security." Question: how did Democrats end up in the position they're in today, and how do they get out of it? Booker: there's a lot of good autopsies that have talked about a generation of Democrats that have lost their connection to farmers or certain unions and the working class. Yet you still had an Obama wave, for example, and then you saw the famous Obama to Trump voters. I think that speaks to what is really important, which is, are we as a party or as individuals who are running for office finding ways to make voters believe that we have a vision for them, that we see them, and we are standing up for them? You have to remember there are multiple states where Trump won in November and the Democratic senator won. So clearly, Democratic senators who overcame all of that, their message was, "Hey, I see you. I'm going to fight for you." So much so that people ticket split. If anything, this last election shows us that who the candidate is matters. Clearly, we had great messengers in our party who overcame pretty tough obstacles. I want to get back to being a party. At least I want to be a leader that doesn't just talk about what I'm against, but what I'm for. to inspire people about the possibilities for themselves, their families, and our nation. Like, hey, yes, things are really bad right now. I'm going to stand up and do everything I can to stop him from hurting you or violating the democratic principles and ideals that we all should be affirming and fighting for. But even in this period, I think it's important that we center people and stand up for them and let them know that my focus isn't Donald Trump. My focus is you, and that's why I'm fighting. But it is important we're providing a compelling vision for America that gets people to believe, again, in us. Forget Democrats when I say us. I mean believe in America. Believe that the American dream has meaning. Question: what does that vision look like to you? Can you be specific? Booker: there's a lot of cynicism now that's growing with Americans feeling like they can't live a better life than their parents. And there's a lot of unfortunate data that backs that up. From 1940 to 1980, there was this massive explosion in the middle class. Social mobility in our country was pretty extraordinary. Now we're more of a classist, more of a static society than even England. But the technological frontiers of this generation create radical possibilities that our parents couldn't even conceive of. Question: what do you mean by that? I believe in the democratizing force of technology, that gaps that we have right now, where education is still so dependent upon what zip code you were born in, where access to capital, whether you're an artist or an entrepreneur, is still very based upon, do you have the privilege to have a social network? Our generation has an opportunity to get away from the binary tribalism and get back to the renewal of the American idea, to make it real to people, and more than anything, accessible to people. That is why people like Ezra Klein fire me up, because he's absolutely right in his book, Abundance. Don't tell me the United States of America is a nation of scarcity. We have the most abundant society on the planet Earth. The issue is not having enough resources, it's allocating them efficiently and effectively. Question: the book Abundance has sparked a debate about whether things like zoning regulations and environmental lawsuits, features of democratic governed states, hamper American progress. Do you agree with the thesis? Booker: I think it's right on the major thematic conclusions, but obviously I read it in a much more sophisticated way from my own experience. When I was mayor of Newark, we were in a recession, and I've got to grow our economy. I've got to create jobs because the unemployment rate is 20%+. And one of the things I saw as an easy answer was the port area. In Newark, kids have asthma rates 4 times higher because the port, the highways, the airport are all there. They breathe in horrible toxins, and around the port, I have all these brown fields, all this fallow land. If we could build acres and acres of warehouses right there, those trucks don't have to idle and drive. You can get that container ship cargo right into the warehouses. It's a win-win. EPA, all of those regulators, were trying to stop me from doing something that would clean up my environment. I still remember having this big fight because they wanted the groundwater standards at my port area to be the same as residential. I'm like, that is utterly stupid. We're going to cap the land. There's no hazard to people working there. I was furious at the red tape and how much they were trying to slow my sprint. I had to beg, borrow, and threaten, often, to get people to move a lot quicker. So that experience supports the book Abundance's conclusion. Question: happy birthday, by the way. How did you celebrate? Booker: I sat on the Capitol steps for about 12 and a half hours with House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries to protest the GOP budget and his proposed cuts to Medicaid. Question: I saw that, and it made me wonder if you have any downtime or if you largely had to sacrifice a personal life for your career. Booker: especially in my early years, I lived a much more one-dimensional life. I have a richer life now than I did as mayor. I didn't understand then that having an enriched personal life makes you better in your service and grounds you more in joy and happiness. Out there on the steps of the Capitol, I had a lot of family members and people close to me. Afterwards, we went back to Hakeem Jeffries' office, and he generously had a birthday cake for me, and I had some of the people I'm closest to there to tease me and make me laugh at myself and love on me. But I have diverse interests. I love reading. I'm a movie addict. Question: what was the last thing you saw in the theaters? Booker: God. Has it been so long that it was Wicked? I'm a huge sci-fi fan and superhero fan, and just a movie fan in general. I came of age in the time of Star Wars, Rocky, E.T. It was my dad who made me such a crazy Star Trek fan. He loved this bold, optimistic view of the future. They banished poverty, they've created a unified Earth, and they're vegetarians. On the bridge of the Enterprise, you've got Asian Americans, African Americans, aliens, and white folks. And I love music. I wake up and listen to podcasts that give me the news of the day, and by the time I'm working out, it's whatever music can get me most pumped up. Question: like what? Booker: I can pull up my Spotify Wrapped from last year. I think I should give you the honest facts. My top 2024 songs: on top is Beyonce, Texas Hold'em, which I think I played way too much. Bruce Springsteen, Stevie Wonder, lots of gospel music. Oh, Bon Jovi's You Give Love a Bad Name made it into the top 20. The Color Purple, Cynthia Erivo's song, I played a lot last year. Question: you covered Newark through the last economic downturn. What are your fears for similar communities around the country if we dip into another recession? Booker: it was economic carnage in Newark. We had foreclosures that were epidemic throughout every neighborhood in Newark. We were seeing people losing their homes, losing their jobs. We had to cut our workforce by 25%, one out of every four workers in City Hall, because we couldn't print money. We had to live within the budget that we had. For me, as a leader during that period, every day you're just choosing from bad to worse. And you're seeing everywhere you go levels of hardship and suffering and struggle. You have people from food banks complaining to you that they're running out of resources. Right now, there's a lot of talk about tariffs, talk about people's 401ks losing value. We've heard from people who are putting off retirement. It could put people into a financial freefall, pushing them further into relying on payday lenders and other ways to get access to resources, which again just puts people into a debt spiral, causes bad outcomes, from losing housing for children to frankly other measures that are painful to think about or relive. Question: how did being in Israel on October 7th influence your views on the war in Gaza and your support for arms sales to Israel? Booker: we were going over to meet with Palestinian leaders in the West Bank because the Saudis were really close to normalizing relations. The irony of it, and this is probably pride coming before the fall, but we were talking with this real sense of joy that for the first time in our lives, we saw a real pathway to a two-state solution. Benjamin Netanyahu, we really believed, was going to be boxed in because he desperately wanted normalization with the Saudis, which was the big win. But the only pathway was to commit to an irrevocable path to a two-state solution. That's what we went over there feeling really excited about. When I left, after the horrors of that day on October 7th, basically the State Department surrounded us with security folks, and we were in and out of the bomb shelter, and they said, "We need to get out." Since then, it's nothing short of a painful reality for my office and myself, seeing the ways Hamas is getting exactly what they want, which is the focus being on Israel as the villain and not the focus on Hamas and what they're doing, even today, to quell people that are trying to protest against them. Now, Bernie Sanders has brought these resolutions of disapproval for arms sales to Israel to the Senate floor. I respect his right to do that. They have no chance of passing in the Senate or the House of Representatives. If anything, they create more division amongst Democrats who, if you polled us, all want a ceasefire and the return of hostages. All of us do. We want a cessation of these hostilities, and we want a pathway back to a two-state solution. I think what he's doing is symbolic, not substantive. We're looking to make a substantive change, and we're going to continue to advocate for that. Question: are you going to run for president in 2028? Answer: it would be the biggest malpractice of my life if I didn't tell you I am running for re-election 2 years before that election. I want to be reelected as a New Jersey senator, and my focus is to let my state know I am 100% focused. Question: what draws you to the work in the Senate right now? It can seem like a pretty frustrating and thankless job, particularly as a Democrat. Booker: it's frustrating as hell, but I tell my team to always look for singles and doubles, and we get a lot, especially when we are advocating for a constituent that did not get the veterans' benefits they deserve, or what have you. But sometimes you hit home runs, like the child tax credit. As a mayor, I could show you some of the proudest things that I accomplished in my life, but that city is only 300,000 people. In this job, I can do things that affect the whole state of New Jersey, 9 million plus, and the nation as a whole. I love this job. I feel like I'm making a big difference, and sometimes the difference you make is just standing up and advocating for issues that are not enough people are standing up for. Now we turn to Rolling Stone's profile. Sarah Silverman, Life After Death: How the Comedian Has Survived Grief, Loss, and Controversy. Sarah Silverman has a shy side. No, really. For years, she avoided doing a podcast because she didn't want to ask her friends to be on another comedy show. Then during the pandemic, Silverman came up with a solution. She made her fans the guests. Now listeners call in to the Sarah Silverman podcast and leave voicemails for your pal Sarah, and then the NYU dropout provides counsel to them. Today, Sarah sits in a West Hollywood studio in jeans, Converse tennis shoes, and a vaguely military flight jacket thingy on top. Her jet black hair is piled up high, and her face is framed by oversized reading glasses. Now age 54, Sarah exudes a sexy homewrecker of Shaker Heights vibe. Her advice to callers can be serious. A month ago, she sympathized with a transgender woman who thought she had to leave the country with President Donald Trump back in office. And graphic, Silverman answered a question on menopausal hormone replacement by gleefully detailing how she lets her partner insert hormone suppositories into her vagina. The calls can also be stupid, like when a man who is 49 but says he looks 35 complains that he can't get respect for the road he's traveled. Silverman has no patience with him. Well, you sound old and your questions are boring. Isn't that something? Her producer cues up another voicemail. Hi, Sarah. Amanda Knox here. Yes, that one. My question has to do specifically with tragedies, or I guess comedy around tragedies. I went through a whole tragic experience myself, wrongly convicted, imprisoned, all of that. And one of the ways that I have coped was to make jokes about it. When I have made jokes, some people have laughed, and some people have called me a psychopath for daring to make any kind of comedy out of the tragedy I went through. And I guess my question to you, Sarah, is someone like me allowed to be funny? Thank you. Silverman pauses to confer with her podcast staff. Is this the Amanda Knox of tabloid fame, wrongly convicted of murdering her roommate in Italy in 27? They confirm that the voice matches up. They resume taping. Yeah, comedy is the relief valve, says Silverman. On the one hand, there is a time and place for it. But on the other hand, the worst and most inappropriate place for its kind of the place for it too. Silverman smiles for a second, possibly remembering her own tragedy plus time, childhood, featuring her father's philandering, her bedwetting, and a brother who died before she was born. Those experiences had led Silverman to describe her younger self as cunty and judgmental. But she has matured into something more substantial that has her producing the best comedy of her career. She gives Amanda Knox permission to do the same. You kind of called the devil on your shoulder for advice on it, says Silverman. You've been through a lot, and comedy is kind of like the flower that comes up through the pavement. It emerges in the darkest spaces. It's a crack of light, but also highly subjective. So something that is a relief for one person maybe is triggering for another. You can't please everyone. Silverman shrugs. I hope that helps. I'm going to assume it probably did not. She is probably wrong. Getting old sucks. You ache in the places where you used to play, as Leonard Cohen said. Your kid's buddy asks him why his grandfather is walking him to school. Also, the people you love die. Sarah Silverman knows this better than most. It's been more than 30 years since she became part of the American cultural landscape with NSFW jokes like, I was raped by a doctor, which is so bittersweet for a Jewish girl. She isn't that girl anymore, although she can still describe her boyfriend giving her a facial that resembles Hitler's mustache. In May 2023, she lost her father and best friend, Donald, and her stepmother, Janice, 9 days apart. Her new Netflix stand-up special, Postmortem, contains some filth, but is mainly a Valentine to loved ones past. On an overcast afternoon, Silverman gives me a tour of the photos on the wall of her Los Angeles living room as her two rescue dogs, Mary and Sibby, linger nearby. Her mom, Beth, smiles down from her frame, wearing her favorite overalls. Beth died in 2015, but Silverman still has her overalls. There's one of Silverman with her boyfriend, Rory Albanese, a producer for Jimmy Kimmel, and other snapshots featuring various combinations of her three sisters and their children scattered between L.A., Australia, and Israel. She narrates her personal history in the small voice that has told 1,001 jokes about fucking. Okay, that's me and Rory. This is my sister Laura and my niece Eliza. She pauses by a photo on the wall of herself wearing a mustache, a Nazi uniform, and a smirk on her face. That's me as Hitler backstage on Conan. She moves on. Okay, this is my best friend, Tall John, at poker. He's 6'10" and wears a shirt of mine, which he bought on Etsy when we play poker. There's one man who appears in more photos than others, and that is her father, Donald Sleppy Silverman. In one, Donald wears a pride shirt and goofy grin outside of the airport diner in Manchester, New Hampshire. Silverman's voice trails off as she looks at the photo of her dad on the wall. He was my best friend, my buddy. She makes an edit. Well, he wasn't my best friend until I was older. He was not physically abusive, but he had uncontrollable rage. Silverman turns her frown upside down. He said that age, enlightenment, and Zoloff were an excellent combination for him. Sarah Silverman tells two stories about her dad, both of which are true. One is happy. The other features unfathomable darkness and is depicted comically in Silverman's memoir, Bedwetter, and the still-developing Bedwetter the Musical, with music by the late Adam Schlesinger. The happy tale is told in Postmortem, streaming now. A joyous remembrance of Sleppy as a wisecracking man who ran Crazy Sophie's factory outlet in Bedford, New Hampshire, where the Silvermans were the only Jewish family. That's the Donald who was madly in love with his second wife, Janice. The Donald who hams it up in sporadic appearances on Sarah's comedy specials and series. The Donald who taught Sarah her first swear words at 3. It's the Donald who was charming enough to persuade his ex-wife, Beth, to regularly cut his toenails and was so afraid of pain that he left the cardiogram stickers on his belly until he fell off naturally rather than experience the mild agony of pulling them off his hairy stomach. Everyone says her dad is unique, the best, says Albanese, who started dating Sarah Silverman after they became online friends playing Call of Duty during the pandemic. But Donald was really unique. Albanese tells me a story about Donald getting a tattoo with the name of his wife on his right butt cheek when he was 80. True to form, Donald howled at the pain. I was telling my parents the story, and Donald was there, says Albanese. And he says, you want to see it? And Donald stands up and just pulls out his right ass right in the restaurant. That's Donald. But Sleppy traveled a long, tortuous road before becoming a mensch. Much of it is detailed in Sarah's book, Bedwetter. My dad had a heartbreaking childhood, Silverman tells me. His dad beat the shit out of him every day, just mercilessly. He had a younger brother who wasn't touched. His father made the kids call him Mr. Silverman. Donald was sent away to Christian school, where he was beaten up repeatedly simply for being the sole Jew. His only solace was Jewish summer camp, where he made friends who he stayed in touch with his entire life. After high school, Donald found a kindred spirit in Beth Ann, Sarah's mom, who was also regularly beaten as a child. The couple moved to Bedford and started a family that eventually begat 4 daughters and a son. But the union wasn't a happy one. Donald was repeatedly unfaithful and belittled his wife's artistic side. She was a painter, and in post-mortem, Silverman recalls how her mom would do dramatic readings of movie times for a local cinema. She was more of a free spirit than my dad, who wanted to be a writer, but instead took over his father's store, says Sarah. Once Sarah married and she became part of him ego-wise, he pounded that out of her. He humiliated her and felt she was lazy because she was in bed a lot. That was before people knew what depression was. But there was more sorrow. 5 years before Sarah was born, her mom won a cruise on a game show, and the couple left their infant son, Jeffrey, home with Donald's parents. The baby died when part of his crib collapsed on him. Jeffrey was never spoken of. One day, her grandmother was driving a 5-year-old Sarah and her 3 older sisters to breakfast and told them to buckle up their seatbelts. Yeah, we don't want to wind up like Jeffrey, said Sarah. The car went quiet, and her grandmother began to weep. Sarah rarely brought up her brother again. Sarah suffered with bedwetting until she was 15, dreading sleepovers and packing diapers for the summers when her dad forced her to go to camp. Her father eventually took her to a psychiatrist who prescribed her Xanax. Soon she was taking 16 tablets a day. Impossibly, it got worse. The doctor hanged himself one day while Sarah was waiting for an appointment to begin. Then Donald and Beth, her parents, split up. Sarah's sisters went to live with him while she stayed with her mom. They had an ugly divorce. My dad spread horrible rumors that she was crazy and I wasn't safe in the house, remembers Silverman, and it wasn't true. Donald turned the corner when he met his second wife shortly after his divorce. Gradually, tensions eased between her parents, and they both remarried. Once they were separate entities and she wasn't a part of his own self-loathing and he dealt with his shit, he could see her as this woman he had wonderful kids with, Silverman says. As a kid, Sarah had been the family cut-up and sang on a cable-access talent show. She went to NYU at 18 and immediately fell in love with stand-up, handing out flyers for a comedy club and working her way up from open mics to $20 gigs. Her dad eventually made her a deal. He would pay for her room and board for 3 years if she wanted to drop out of college and pursue comedy. Silverman had an early success, becoming a Saturday Night Live writer at age 22, but was fired after one season, at least partially because she playfully threw a pencil that stabbed Al Franken in the forehead. She wasn't happy. I caught rage from my dad, says Silverman. 2 things changed her life, Zoloff and Gary Sandling. After being fired from Saturday Night Live, Silverman scored a part playing a misunderstanding, filthy comedy writer on The Larry Sanders Show, Sandling's classic send-up of the talk show game. He invited her along with some other friends to his Malibu home. Soon, she was joining Sandling and his friends in his regular pickup basketball games. Sandling, a follower of Buddha and New Advice guru Eckhart Tolle, shared wisdom with Silverman about suffering. He was always searching because he was tortured, she says. He really passed on that experience, hard lessons you learned in hard ways they just gave us on a silver platter. There's pain you had to experience, and there is some pain that could be avoided. Many of Gary Shandling's lessons centered around having empathy in both your own life and in your comedy. It took decades for that to sink in with Sarah Silverman. In her 2005 special, Jesus is Magic, she's finishing a bit on undersized humans preferring to be called little people rather than midgets, when she perhaps unwittingly puts her finger on her and American comedy's predilection for punching down for laughs. "I tell you why we make fun of midgets," she says in the special. "We're not afraid of them. That's what it boils down to, you know. I mean, I had a joke with the word nigger in it, and I thought it was so edgy and hip. I was at this one club doing my show, and I looked in the front row, and the whole table is black people or African-American people, and I didn't do it because I was afraid of them." Silverman pauses. "And I ended up changing that joke to chinks, so you live and you learn." Silverman's riff was standard fare for much of her career. She's been pillared for doing an episode of her first television show, The Sarah Silverman Program, in blackface, and protested by Asian American groups for her use of the aforementioned slur, chinks, on Conan. She regrets all that. "I felt like the temperature of the world around me at the time was, we are all liberal, so we can say the N-word," says Silverman. "We aren't racist, so we can say this derogatory stuff. I was playing a character that was arrogant and ignorant, so I thought it was okay. Looking back, my intentions were always good, but they were fucking ignorant." Silverman devoted an episode to her blackface incident on her Hulu show, I Love You America, back in 2018, and also apologized for crude jokes she made about Paris Hilton and Britney Spears in earlier years. "I don't think of myself as being PC out of fear," says Silverman. "Some people got mad at me for apologizing. I only did that because I was sorry. That's a really great rule of thumb. Only apologize when you're sorry." Silverman's face brightens. "Always apologize when you're sorry." Silverman's relationship with her friend Dave Chappelle is instructive. In 2019, she introduced Chappelle when he was awarded the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. Last November, she found herself in Ohio on election night and watched the returns in despair with him. As the night went on, he was saying, "She's still going to get it. There's still a way," she says. He was doing the desperate math in his head that we all did. In between those two events, in 2022, Chappelle did an SNL monologue riffing on anti-Semitic social media posts by Kanye West and NBA star Kyrie Irving. On her podcast, Silverman described her friend's monologue as hilarious and brilliant and winning and charming and wildly anti-Semitic. Silverman eventually plays a clip from the monologue where Chappelle makes a fantastical leap, claiming that Jewish Americans holding West and Irving accountable for their racism were scapegoating blacks. "This is where you know I draw a line," Chappelle says. "I know the Jewish people have been through terrible things all over the world, but you can't blame them on black Americans. You just can't." Silverman came back at him. He's kind of like Jimmy Stewart stutters at the end to give it a little folksy truth-telling charm, says Silverman. "But fuck, the idea that calling out massively influential zillionaire superstars for posting lies and promoting hatreds of Jews is the Jews blaming their troubles on black Americans is fucking insane. I can't believe I have to say this." When we talk, Silverman isn't interested in relitigating the issue, but it goes to a larger concern of hers that traces in a way back to her dad, how men channel confusion and depression into rage. She describes it in the context of the anger that she sees many men direct towards the transgender community. "Men have been raised to not be able to feel, not be able to express themselves," says Silverman. "The only acceptable emotion for some reason is anger. So what happens? They feel shame, and that immediately, like sugar getting converted to carbs, that gets converted into rage and outward blame, and that's how they survive. When I see that anger directed at the trans community, at the non-specific, non-binary, it has nothing to do with them and everything to do with themselves. It's ego and the terror of, if that's who they are, then who am I? Where do I fall? Sarah Silverman isn't immune to reacting emotionally to issues that cut to the bone. She wasn't raised religious, but is hyper-aware of his Jewishness and being sent as the others in polite society. In the Bedwetter musical, a 10-year-old Sarah is confronted by her Gentile classmates, who taunt, "You're short and dark and ooey." She replies, "I know what you mean. I'm totally Jewy. I'm the type of kid that's too Jewy to ignore." That hard-to-ignore quality hasn't always worked out well for her. When some critics expressed horror at Bradley Cooper's utilization of a prosthetic nose in his Leonard Bernstein's biopic Maestro, her phone rang off the hook with comment requests from reporters, many of whom completely missed that Silverman was in the movie playing Bernstein's sister. She has confessed to feeling no emotional attachment to Israel, but with some of her family living there, the Hamas massacre of Israel on October 7, 2023, left her devastated. A few days after the attack, Silverman reposted on Instagram post suggesting Israel had no obligation to provide food and water to Gaza. She immediately received a wave of backlash from friends and critics. She apologized, but still seemed shook and uncertain about how to deal with the conflict as a comedian. Seeing the reactions to October 7th left her stunned, she says. The alienation of liberal Jews was astounding. Everyone's afraid to say anything. I couldn't even imagine doing stand-up. I was scared. And it was Chelsea Handler who was like, "Get your fucking ass up. Your job is to make people laugh. That's your job." And I needed that. Boy, I needed that. And then she made me open for her at the Pantages Theater. And it was honestly a gift because I realized that it's important. This concludes a reading of the Rolling Stone magazine for today. Tune in next week for the rest of the June 2025 edition of Rolling Stone. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.